News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump says he will accept a deal to at least temporarily reopen the federal government if it contained a prorated down payment on the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump said the country has no choice but to build a wall to keep out what he says is a virtual invasion by criminals, human traffickers, and drugs.
Everybody, look, for the most part, people agree. When I say everybody, I would say almost everybody agree. We have to have border security. We have to have a wall in order to have border security. You cannot have border security without a wall.
Trump was speaking after the Senate rejected two bills that would have ended a partial government shutdown now headed into its 35th day. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the crisis is one of the president's own making and one he can easily solve.
It shouldn't go on any longer. We should at least be able to discuss and compare the merits of our different proposals.
Meanwhile, 800,000 federal workers remain off the job or are working without getting paid. A U.S. Senate committee has subpoenaed President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, to testify a day after Cohen said he was postponing an appearance that was scheduled for February 7th. AP's Warren Levinson has details.
Cohen lawyer Lanny Davis disclosed the Senate subpoena in a brief statement. Cohen has already put off plans to testify before a House panel, citing his continuing cooperation with the special counsel and, Davis told ABC's Good Morning America, threats made against his family.
The House of Representatives now has an obligation, a resolution of censure when the President of the United States indisputably intimidates and obstructs justice to prevent a witness from testifying.
Cohen worked on efforts to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. It wasn't immediately clear what the Senate Intelligence Committee might want to talk to him about. Warren Levinson, New York.
And more at voenews.com. This is VOA News. The U.S. State Department ordered a non-essential personnel to leave Venezuela, but it is not closing its embassy in Caracas. On Wednesday, Venezuela's disputed president, Nicolas Maduro, said he was ending diplomatic relations with the United States in response to President Trump's announcement that the U.S. was officially recognizing National Assembly President Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim leader. In remarks to the Organization of American States Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged all members to recognize Guaido as Venezuela's leader.
The regime of former President Nicolas Maduro is illegitimate. We therefore consider all of its declarations and actions illegitimate and invalid.
And in a speech to the Venezuelan Supreme Court, a defiant President Maduro said U.S. President Donald Trump is trying to bring in his own de facto government in Venezuela.
Creo que en el mundo no queda duda que es el propio Donald Trump que quiere imponer un gobierno de facto inconstitucional.
Maduro said he had spoken by phone with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who assured him that, in Maduro's words, you have the unwavering support of Russia more than ever. The U.S. is implementing new protocols Friday for processing some migrants who attempt to enter the country, crossing with Mexico. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security said the migrant protection protocols will return some asylum seekers to Mexico as they wait for their cases to be processed in the United States. DHS said the U.S. is facing a security and humanitarian crisis on the southern border, and that it is why it has implemented the MPP to address the crisis and execute missions to secure the border, enforce immigration and customs laws, facilitate legal trade and travel, counter traffickers, smugglers, and transitional criminal organizations, and interdict drugs and illegal contraband. Félix Tshisekedi has been sworn in Thursday as the Democratic Republic of Congo's new president, marking the first peaceful transfer of power in the country's history. In his inaugural address, the new president pledged to build a strong, unified nation.
Nous voulons construire un Congo fort dans sa diversité culturelle et son attachement à la...
Tshisekedi's victory in the December 30th election was a surprise to many, as pre-election polls actually indicated businessman Martin Fayulu would be the winner. Fayulu challenged the official results in court, saying he was the actual winner of the election. Congo's Constitutional Court denied Fayulu's request for a recount last weekend. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 25th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Nigeria's main opposition PDP candidate challenges President Muhammadu Buhari to a debate before the February 16th elections.
Our candidate, the people's candidate, Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, is prepared to debate the incumbent president, President Muhammadu Buhari, every day, anytime, everywhere.
Kola Olubundinya is the spokesman for Nigeria's opposition People's Democratic Party. There is a noticeable lack of female candidates in Senegal's February presidential election. Following weeks of protest, some citizens say Zimbabwe resembles a war zone, and Sudan braces for more anti-government protests today, Friday.
More demonstration is going to come out of the mosque because this is where the area mostly fights to start the demonstration after the Juma prayer.
Hussein Shingraya is a member of the National Front for Change Party and will tell you why some world leaders stay away from this year's World Economic Forum. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, says its candidate, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, is challenging incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari to a debate before the February 16th elections. The party says the debate would help prospective Nigerian voters make up their minds about which candidate has the policy to address the country's ongoing security and economic challenges, as well as create jobs for the youth. President Buhari skipped the recent debate due to what officials said was a conflict in the president's schedule. The PDP remark came after civil society groups called for another televised national presidential debate for the major candidates. Kola Olubundinya is PDP spokesman.
Our position is that our candidate, the people's candidate, Alhaji Atiku Abubakar, is prepared to debate the incumbent president, President Muhammadu Buhari, every day, anytime, everywhere, including the banquet hall of Aso Villa. So we are ready, and our candidate is prepared to express itself to Nigerians.
Well, some of his supporters are saying you seem to be making political gains out of his unfortunate medical condition, which has significantly improved, and that this is just politics as usual to score cheap political points.
I do not agree with such supporters of President Muhammadu Buhari. And I say so clearly that if you are coming before Nigerians as an incumbent, you must be prepared to market to Nigerians, to tell Nigerians what you have done with a trust that they reposed in you almost 4 years ago. If you have a situation where you have failed and failed woefully in demonstrating capacity and competence in the affairs of governance, you cannot blame the opposition for telling the Nigerians that they are prepared to revive the economy that you have failed to revive, that they are prepared to unite our nation, which you have failed woefully to unite, and they are prepared to fight corruption, which you pledge that you will do and fail to do. The opposition is also prepared to fight and revive the economy. And as far as the People's Democratic Party is concerned, we have a responsibility to hold this government accountable to Nigerians on the basis of its failures. And that is what the PDP has done. And our candidate has presented a manifesto that Nigerians believe in. And that is why the majority of Nigerians today are rallying with our candidate, the People's candidate, Alhaji Atiku Abubakar.
The government has said Boko Haram has been defeated technically and that the areas that they used to control, they don't control anymore. They have rendered Boko Haram ineffective. The president continued to implement policies to jumpstart the economy, to help alleviate the suffering of Nigerians. So Nigerians are with the president.
If the government at any point in time did say that it has conquered Boko Haram, that is an absolute deception. And I say so because the governor of Borno State, where the Boko Haram tragedy started from, who was also elected into office on the platform of the same All Progressives Congress like President Muhammadu Buhari, a few weeks back, cried to the villa, the presidential villa, and told Mr. President that security has failed in his home state. And I also quickly want to remind you that when in 2015, PDP was voted out of power, the issue of insecurity was essentially an issue of the Northeast and largely Borno State. But as we speak today, insurgency and banditry have spread to the Northwest. As we speak today, banditry, killings, and bloodletting have spread to the North Central. These are manifest reasons that show clearly to the nation that President Muhammadu Buhari has failed.
Kola Ologbondinya is a spokesman for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. As Senegalese prepare to vote in presidential election next month, there is a noticeable lack of female candidates. All of the candidates in this year's election are men. Awa Ba, Senegal country officer for the Open Society Initiative, tells Ricky Shryak that the male candidates are not addressing women's rights issues.
This is a sad situation because I think at least for the past two presidential elections, we have had women candidates even beyond those two. There is no problem at the legislative representation because we have a parity law, thanks to which we have had women representation at National Assembly ranging from 42% to 43%. But to my view, the issue is with the political parties and women's representation, women's voice inside political parties. If we didn't have the parity law, I know for sure that we wouldn't have this number of women at the parliament. So which means that at the level of political parties, there is still work to do to empower women, to enhance their presence, and then to give them more visibility and more responsibilities.
What are the real impacts that this lack of women at the leadership level in political parties has on people in Senegal?
It impacts greatly in the way that you don't have a very strong leadership women in pushing some of these issues. You look at the National Assembly today, the way it works. Even though you have a fair, good number of women, you don't have a strong women's movement or parliamentary movement that tries to push some agenda for advancing women's rights or girls' rights, or even some social issues.
Do you think there is a candidate in the current field, although there are no female candidates, who best represents a push for women's rights?
That's the other concern we have. As you might have noticed, so far, I haven't myself heard any candidate addressing specifically issues of what kind of inclusive society you want to have, where do we see women, the place of women, the place of girls, how do we want to have a society that is egalitarian in terms of rights for women, in terms of access to job, access to training for girls and women? We don't see it. It's like women are merged. It's not a specific category that they would address in the way that it's there are some sexual-specific politics you want to put in place when you want to bridge some gaps in terms of discrimination on access to work, access to education, to maintain good education, but also to fight some of these harmful practices, but also patriarchy in general.
That was Awa Ba, Senegal country officer for the Open Society Initiative. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, January 25th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Sudan is bracing for more anti-government protests today, Friday, following what organizers call the largest nation nationwide protest yesterday, Thursday. The Associated Press reported that a 24-year-old man died of wounds he sustained, bringing the total number of dead demonstrators to 29 since the start of the protest. The protest began in mid-December over high commodity prices, but then the protesters began to demand the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir, in power for 30 years. But President Bashir says there can be no change of leadership in Sudan except through the ballot box. Hussein Shinkraye is a member of the opposition National Front for Change political party.
There was this morning a protest start at 1 o'clock for 17 different locations. And it's been the biggest one it's happened since this protest started. And was it 17 places in the capital area of Khartoum, and also not less than 200 different cities and villages. They did the same thing, a big demonstration.
Were there any casualties in terms of anyone being killed?
Yes, actually, there is two people. One of them is the student of the University of Arazi, and it's been killed by the torture of the security.
What do you expect for today, Friday?
We're expecting also another more demonstration. It's going to come out of the mosque because this is where the area mostly Fridays start the demonstration after the Juma prayers.
Of course, President Bashir, the call for him to step down, the president has said he's not going to do it, that you all should go to an election if you want to change.
Yes, that's actually what he's always talking about, and his party also talking about the election in 2020. But nobody's trusting their invitation because what is happening like before was not a fair election. In 2015 and before 2010 was a lot of cheating in the elections. And I think people, they pass that now because now they're asking just for the whole regime to step down.
So are schools in session during this protest? Are students coming to school or going to school?
There is some students go to school, but like most of the people, they ask their kids not to go to school. Actually, the attendance is probably less than 50%. But the government, they're insisting, the student to go back to school because they want to show that everything is normal. And yesterday also, there's a big thing happening in Port Sudan, which is nearby the Red Sea. And there was a fight between the military and the security, and seemed to be like even there is a casualties from the security. One person got killed yesterday by the army because they're fighting each other.
President Bashir, I think he had gone to Qatar. Is he back in the country, and what did he bring back?
I think he came empty-handed from Qatar.
What do you mean?
I mean, there is nothing, there is no promise from the Qatari government for supporting the economy of Sudan, even not a promise for oil and gas or money or, wheat or anything.
Hussein Shinkraye is a member of the opposition National Front for Change political party in Sudan. He was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. Some citizens in Zimbabwe who claim they were assaulted by the army are saying the country resembles a war zone. They want President Emmerson Mnangagwa to rein in military forces, which reportedly continue assaulting Zimbabweans a week after the country's protests over a fuel price hike. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
While it appears as if it's all back to business in the capital, Harare, after last week's violent protests, some Zimbabweans do not think so. They say the army continues assaulting them. One of the victims is this 41-year-old woman who says she was assaulted Sunday as she was walking with her husband and their two kids. A gun butt was used and she broke her right elbow. Her husband can't walk because she was struck in the back. It is an indirect war situation, but they are fighting with people who are not armed. But the army will be armed. I wish they could stop it, says this woman. So many people have been injured and fear to go seek medication. The moment it gets to 5 p.m., we lock our doors, because if they meet you after 6 p.m. in the streets, they will assault you. But if you are unlucky, even around 2 a.m., they can come assault you indoors. We are having sleepless nights, she adds. The Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission said heavy-handedness and the use of live ammunition by military forces to quash the protests have resulted in 8 deaths. Mnangagwa tweeted that heads would roar among security forces for any brutality. But late Wednesday, his spokesman George Charamba came to the defense of Zimbabwe's security forces for their actions during last week's protests, which have attracted condemnation.
There's a fundamental question to ask here. Why so indulgently condone violence that we so gratuitously visited on this society? Why do that? When that happens, necessarily, the authority of the state is in question. And I can assure you, if the authority of the state is in question, the state has an obligation to demonstrate that it exists to ensure law and order. And that's exactly what happened.
But the 41-year-old woman who says she now can't fend for her 2 children since her right hand is broken as a message from Mnangagwa, who is also Zimbabwe's commander-in-chief. I'm appealing to him to tell the army not to beat up people because we now fear to stay even in our homes because anytime soldiers can come, fire tear gas through windows if people do not open doors. Even innocent children are being affected. We now live in fear of being assaulted for no reason. Dewa Mavinga, the Southern Africa director at Human Rights Watch, said Charamba had totally missed the point. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
This year's World Economic Forum Summit in Davos, Switzerland, which concludes today, Friday, has some notable absentees, including U.S. President Donald Trump. With backlash against a perceived ruling elite gaining ground in many countries, some leaders are steering clear of a gathering often seen as an inaccessible club for the world's super rich. But others say it is vital that they get together to discuss urgent issues like climate change. Henry Richwell reports.
On the surface, it's business as usual at Davos. On a sealed-off, snowbound mountaintop, world leaders rub shoulders with global executives, lobbyists and pressure groups. A vital gathering of global decision-makers, says Leslie Vinjamuri of policy group Chatham House.
They're there to do business. They're there to engage in an exchange of ideas. And so I think it's still tremendously important.
But this year, there's no American delegation. President Trump has stayed away amid the US government shutdown. China's President Xi Jinping isn't here. Neither is Britain's Theresa May, nor France's President Emmanuel Macron.
They're tremendously preoccupied with the troubles that they face at home, which isn't a good sign for globalism. The criticism and the critique that surrounds Davos is extraordinary. People say, you know, it's where all those people go to sort of have dinner with each other. Has nothing to do with the rest of us. And of course, it's about a lot more than that, but the optics are tremendously negative at this point in time.
While Davos is sealed off by high security, delegates are well aware of a growing global backlash. David Gergen of the Harvard Kennedy School echoed the concerns of many at Davos during one debate this week.
We've had some good economic times. Incomes have gone up in a number of countries, and yet the discontent is deep. And it's threatening our democracies.
The absence of many big players means others have stolen the limelight. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali has been widely praised for making peace with Eritrea. He said African countries must deepen their ties.
We believe integration must be viewed not just as an economic project, but also as crucial to securing peace and reconciliation in the Horn of Africa.
Other issues, too, have risen up the Davos agenda, notably climate change. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern urged action.
This is about being on the right side of history. And do you want to be a leader that you look back in time and say that you were on the wrong side of the argument when the world was crying out for a solution?
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that, I think.
But Davos 2019 will likely be remembered for the lack of global leadership, says analyst Vinjamuri.
That space has been vacated. Nobody necessarily even wants to take things forward at the level of providing a vision and a set of tangible policy proposals for how to actually implement a vision that can carry us through a really troubling time.
The lack of such a vision at a time of profound global change has sent a chill far beyond the confines of this winter resort. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sport with the draws for the CAF Confederations Cup, which took place earlier this week in Cairo, Egypt. In Group A, Hassania Agadir of Morocco, AS Otoho of Congo, RS Bakane of Morocco, and Raja Casablanca of Morocco will all slog it out for the top spot from that group. Group B have Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia, Rangers of Nigeria, Salites of Burkina Faso, and CS Sfaxien of Tunisia. While in Group C, the likes of Zesco United of Zambia, Al Hilal of Sudan, Asante Kotoko of Ghana, Nkana of Zambia will all battle for the quarterfinal spot, while Group D will see Goma Hia of Kenya, N.A. Hussein Day of Algeria, Petro Atletico of Angola, Zamalek of Egypt, all will battle for the top spots from the group. Reacting to the draws and prospects of the teams is a football analyst, Alfred Sarki.
I must confess, this year's Champions CAF Confederations Cup actually could go for the CAF Champions League, because basically we have perennial winners of the CAF Champions League playing in the CAF Confederations Cup. All the groups are interesting because I see the North African teams, we have so many of them, so I see them in almost all the groups, so I expect that basically the North African teams will come out.
In the meantime, Cameroonian side Cotton Sport Garoua have reported Ghanaian club Asante Kotoko to the Confederation of African Football over what they described as irregularity of Kwame Bonsu after their two-legged encounter in the playoff phase of the Confederation's Cup. The Cameroonian side warned the Ghanaian club to be thrown out of the Confederation's Cup group stages after claiming that documents tendered during their matches with the Ghanaian club carried Kwame Bonsu's name in jersey number 8, while the documents of the reverse fixture have the same player's name affiliated to the number 3 jersey, which is a violation of Article 6.5 of the competition's rules. Edmond Anka, a member of Asante Kotoko's management, has dismissed the allegations.
Kwame Bonsu will never ever wear number 8 jersey, because even in that jersey, the players' names are at the back of the jersey. So how can a number 3 jersey, which has a name by name Kwame Bonsu, wear number 8 jersey by name Kwame Boyan? So they have no case at all. They are jokers.
And finally, in athletics news, World and Commonwealth 5,000 meters champion Helen Obiri will be chasing her fourth title at this year's Kenya Defense Forces Cross-Country Championships set for today at Kahawa Garrison. Helen Obiri, who is also the Africa 5,000 meters champion, said her ultimate dream is to represent Kenya for the first time at a World Cross-Country slated for March 30th this year in Aarhus in Denmark. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, January 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Zara Abuzeh, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. we take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.